John McMurray, sitting this morning on October the 10th, 2016, with Ben Tritipo, who is an official scorer for the Washington Nationals and has been with the team since their inception in 2005. And Ben, I wanted to ask you if you could explain to me what your role with the team is as an official scorer.
Well, as an official scorer, we're officially employed by Major League Baseball. We work with the team. We get benefits from the team in terms of, a spot in the press box, provide us with free parking, a free pregame meal, which is all great. But, in the end, we're not beholden to the team. We're not employed by the team. So we can maintain a neutral status in that way. The Nationals staff, the media relations staff, has always been great to us and, understands that relationship as well. And, we'll, at times, if there's a play in a game, they were like, well, could you take another look? I thought maybe that should be a hit instead of an error. As long as it's approached the right way, I'm happy with trying to take another look. There's been times I take another look, see a different angle, and it was like, oh, okay, now I see what they saw, and that sort of thing. So, but it's a very good relationship, with the team, through Major League Baseball.
Now, when you are with a particular team as an official scorer, often you will hear people allege that scoring decisions are made with that particular team in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Can you discuss the objectivity that you have to have in your position?
That's a good question. Is that you're obviously you're from this area. I grew up in Northern Virginia. I can remember the Washington Senators. I was 6 years old when the Senators left town in 1971. So there's an allegiance to the area. When the Expos, where it was announced the Expos were going to move to Washington for the 2005 season, I was ecstatic. Baseball's back in Washington. This is great. And yes, I'm a Nationals fan. But there, like you said, there has to be that objectivity when you're doing the job. And I look at it sometimes, I may be even tougher on the Nationals because I don't want it to come across that there's any favoritism. I may score an error on the home team that, somebody else might score a hit because I want to make sure it doesn't come across I'm favoring the home team. I may go back later and look at it again and say, okay, well, maybe that really should be a hit, but I will tend to go on the tougher side than maybe the easier side initially on a play. But that's a big key to it. And, I definitely want to come off as not being seen as a homer, for the home team. And you'll get yelled at sometimes for that. It's like, well, we should get that call. We're at home. I'm like, well, that's not the case. It's here's the rule, here's the play, and I'm trying to be fair and even on everything. And I think I'm respected for that. I've had a number of writers, a number of other people, and a number of the visiting media relations people that have come to me, at separate times. And, I appreciate what you do. That, it's a tough job, but I think you try to handle it in a fair and even manner. You don't show a favoritism for the home team.
Now, particularly with contracts that have incentives for certain statistical milestones, whether it's stolen bases or what have you, do you find that people pay more attention to the decision of official scorers than they might have in decades past?
Probably so. I would say you're right, and particularly in this day and age of high money contracts, and a lot of times with the last player collective bargaining agreement, which was I think about 4 years ago now, there became the option that players, agents, the teams, the coaches can appeal a scoring decision directly to Major League Baseball. And those have increased incrementally the last 4 years. We've had a conference of the official scorers in New York each of the last five seasons. And the first year in 2012, I think, was the year that was going into effect. So 2013, when we had our conference, they told us, okay, there were like 200 plays appealed last season, you know, to MLB. And I don't remember the exact number that got overturned at that time, but it, you know, it's less than like 20%. The next year it was like 300. The next year it was 400. You know, so there's, and I know a number of the plays that I've been alerted to that have been appealed of mine are mainly pitchers trying to get errors on people so that they don't get runs. Yeah, it's not as much guys trying to get errors switched to hits. It's pitchers trying to get hits switched to errors so that they can get the benefit of it for their ERAs and obviously their statistical purposes. Yeah, it's an interesting, you know, concept, and it's one you wish you didn't have to deal with, you know, in a lot of cases, but it's part of the game and, you know, part of what you have to deal with.
Now, fewer and fewer fans score the game in the stands relative to years past. What do you enjoy about the process of being an official scorer? Because it is very technical, and in some sense, even as a fan yourself, you can't enjoy the game in a traditional sense when you have to be concerned with all of the minutiae for hours on end and make sure you don't make a mistake.
Right. It's, I've been scoring in some capacity, I've told people, since, you know, I was a kid. You know, my dad taught me how to score, you know, at a game, and obviously not as intricately as I do it today. But, you know, I'm probably like most people as an official scorer, as a writer or a journalist, a broadcaster, I'm a frustrated ball player. You know, I loved the game growing up, played through Little League. You know, the curveball did me in, couldn't hit the curveball, so that ended my career, you know, before I even got to high school. But, you know, I kept the scorebook for my high school baseball team. You know, I just wanted to be around the game. Going into, after I got out of college, I ended up going into collegiate sports information, media relations for the college athletic teams. And, you know, one of my first things was working with the baseball team, and I'm keeping score again. So I said, I've been doing this in some capacity for probably 35 years. And it just, the intricacies of it, the nuances of the game, you know, the differences between a college player trying to field a ground ball and a major league player fielding a ground ball is amazing, you know, from the amount of the bat speed, you know, the speed the ball's been hit, the reaction time, you know, you just get to see all those, like you said, the minutiae of the game, you know, the shifts, the, you know, you've got to make sure, you know, was that actually the third baseman who was over on the right side of second base, or, you know, is it the shortstop, you know, who is it out there actually making plays? But that's me. I've always been a detail-oriented type of person, and, you know, keeping track of pitch by pitch and everything. It's just something that appeals to me. I love, even when I'm sitting in the stands just watching the game now, you know, I'm still, okay, it counts 2-1, you know, what are they going to do? Is it a hit and run situation, which doesn't happen a whole lot anymore? You know, but those type of things. But that's kind of the thing, that the passion I have for the game.
And you are one of the Nationals' official scorers. You've been with the team now for 11 years.
12 years.
12 years.
Right.
And David Vincent is well known as the Nationals' official scorer as well, and you work with him. Can you describe the path of how you got to becoming a Nationals' official scorer? You had been in the minor leagues before, but if you could outline how you got from there to here.
Sure.
That would be wonderful.
In 2003, I was working at George Mason University in the sports information office, and a friend who was working for the Potomac Nationals, the Class A minor league team that's affiliate now with the Washington Nationals. They were an affiliate with the Cincinnati Reds at that time. He knew me. Dave had mentioned apparently one day in the press box, you know, I'd like to find a guy who could sub for me for a few games so I can take some days off here and there. And my friend contacted me. He said, hey, Dave's looking for some some help. Would you be interested in scoring a few games? I'm like, yeah, that sounds pretty neat. I'd like to do that. So he got me together with Dave and, you know, hooked up. I think the 2003 summer, you know, he wanted to take a weekend off for a, you know, a vacation trip. And so I covered three or four games for him. And I was like, okay, this is pretty cool. You know, it's a little different from the college game, you know, a little faster and, you know, a little more intricate in what you're seeing and what you're scoring. So with that working out pretty well, Dave contacted me the next year. He said, you know, he said, I want to take a whole week off. Would you be okay with doing that? I'm like, yeah, let's do that. So I think I did like six games. And, you know, I was starting to enjoy it. You know, and I was like, this is pretty neat. And fall of 2004, Major League Baseball made the announcement that the Montreal Expos were going to move to Washington, become the new franchise in D.C., and, you know, obviously excited about that as a fan. But Dave gave me a call and he said, you know, I know a lot of the Major League people from his dealings through Sabre, you know, as the home run historian. And he said, I'm going to pursue becoming their official scorer. And he said, I know they're going to want at least two people because it's not a full-time job. It's a game-to-game job. You know, the person doing it obviously has a job on the side because you're not going to make enough money to live off of it for, you know, your regular income. But he said, you know, he said, I know they're going to want a second person. He said, you want to go at it as a team? I said, that would be awesome. I said, you know, it'd be a great thing. He said, you know, I'd been trying for a couple of years to get into Major League Baseball in the media relations capacity or some capacity, you know, had some contacts, but things, you know, hadn't developed into a full-time position. So Dave had contacted John Dever, who was the Nationals media relations director at the time, and had told him, you know, about me. It turned out the Nationals hired as their assistant media relations director, a fella, and his name's escaping me at the moment, but he had been at George Washington University and knew me through, you know, our college dealing. And he had recommended that I be one of the official scorers as well. So when it came around to the Nationals making a recommendation to MLB for who they wanted to be their official scorers, it was Dave and I. And we got hired. I think we found out literally like 2 weeks before the season started that we would officially be the scorers. And, you know, we moved into the 2005 season as the two official scorers for the Washington Nationals. Now, with Dave having done about 12 years at Potomac already, he and I split up the Potomac games as well. So if I think for the first 4 years before the big Nationals added a third scorer into the mix in Washington, it was just Dave and I, and we were doing both Washington and Potomac for the whole summer. So between the two, 151 home games, a lot of games to pick up. I think Dave was doing about between 40 and 50 in D.C. I was doing about 30 to 35. I think I was doing a few more in Potomac than he was, so I might have been doing 35 to 40 in Potomac. And so, you know, doing 60 to 70 games between April and September, you know, between the two teams when you're working a full-time job as well. Yeah, you know, gets a little hectic at times, but it's fun, and it was a passion, and, you know, the love of the game, you know, kept me going, and I really, really do appreciate the opportunity, and Dave was a big part of that. You know, without him, you know, I may not be in this position today, so I really do appreciate, you know, what he's done to help me out over these years.
Now, before you become an official scorer, you have to have a mastery of the rule book. You can't be just figuring it out and looking it up as you go along.
Right.
Although in some of the difficult cases, you may need to think about it a bit.
Definitely.
But where did you get your mastery of the rule book that was necessary for you to become an official scorer?
Well, once, you know, I had done, like I said, I had been in the college ranks for 12 years at George Mason at that time, and had been the baseball sports information director for Mason, so knew the college rule book, you know, very well. There's little intricacies between the two. There's some things, you know, the DH situation, the pitcher in college, the pitcher can hit at the start of the game and you can designate him at the beginning that if he comes out as the pitcher, he can become the DH, you know, which you can't do in pro ball. There were differences at that time in the interference rules, like around second, like today now baseball, MLB has the slide rule in at second base. You got to slide straight into the bag or it's interference. That had been in college for years, you know, so I understood that play, you know, when it came into effect with pro. But, you know, Dave had loaned me one of the pro score rule books when I started subbing for him. You know, so I read through, he was like, you know, I know these are a couple of the rules, you know, that might be different. You know, make sure you know those and that sort of thing. So, yeah, just, you know, kind of reading it, rereading it, you know, trying to make yourself familiar with it was a big key. But I say even as the years have gone along, there's intricacies to the rules that have come up that throw me. It actually was a game in Washington, maybe my fifth or sixth year of scoring. The Nationals and the Phillies were playing. It went to the top of the sixth inning. Philadelphia was ahead 6-0. And the first batter walked and the rain came. I mean, just poured. Wasn't going to stop. So within the hour that they kind of wait, they finally called the game. Well, in the bottom of the fifth, with the Nationals batting, the Phillies had a rookie pitcher that had started the game. Well, he started to struggle a little bit. Pitch count was getting up. They pulled him out after 4 2/3 innings. So the reliever comes in, finishes the inning. They go to the top of the sixth, you know, basically gets washed out. So in my mind, I'm thinking the rule, you've got to go 5 innings as a starting pitcher to be credited for the win. So as I fill out my post-game report, I gave the win to the relief pitcher. So, send everything in, I'm driving home, my phone starts ringing. And I'm like, didn't recognize the number, but I finally picked it up, and it was the Elias Sports Bureau from New York. And they're the people we turn our reports into after each game. And gentleman on the other end, he said, you incorrectly identified the winning pitcher in the game. And I'm like, well, no, I didn't. I said, the starter didn't go 5, so the reliever had to get the win. And he's like, according to rule, and he started citing the rule, there is an obscure rule that if a game is only goes through 5 innings defensively, the winning pitcher only has to pitch 4 innings to get credit for the win. And I'm like, okay. And I'd like, you know, you could read the rule book 1,000 times and I guarantee you that one would not stick in my mind. Now it does. So I do know that rule more clearly now.
Are there rules that you find particularly difficult to apply when in the course of a game?
How do you mean?
Well, in the sense of, are there rules that you find to be ambiguous that you have to put a particular amount of interpretation into?
Well, I guess the biggest one on that is the error rule. You know, the way the error rule reads is, you know, essentially it's an error is a play that is not made, or it could be made with ordinary effort by an average fielder. Okay. First question, what's ordinary effort? Second question, who's the average fielder? You know, if you're telling me, you know, Ryan Zimmerman, when he was a great third baseman, you know, is an average fielder, then everybody's got to be held to Ryan's standard for fielding a ground ball. You know, we know he's above average, you know, in that category. But that would lead, you know, and that's the big question a lot of times with things is, what is that ordinary effort? What is the, you know, what can an average fielder get to? So that leaves an incredible amount of interpretation to that rule. One benefit that we've had, especially these last 5 years, was having the start of the conference of official scorers every year. The first year, there's a group of the older official scorers. that kind of did started the seminar and went through a lot of those type of things. You know, here's what we believe should be the definition of ordinary effort. One of those guys was a fella, he's the one of the official scorers in Tampa, had been a college baseball coach for 25 years. So, you know, he's teaching how to field ground balls, how to chase fly balls. And he basically came up with what they call the athletic standard for it. And, you know, their recommendation, you know, pretty much for a ground ball, anything more than 2 to 3 steps to a player's left or right is beyond ordinary effort. You know, if it's a ground ball that takes a bad hop, you know, if it's below the knee, that's reasonably expected and you can make an adjustment to field it. If it's above the knee, that's maybe too much to expect that they can field it with ordinary effort.
But a slow ground ball is different than a fast ground ball too.
Correct.
One that's close to the ground versus one that bounces high is also different. So
true.
How do you take all of that into account?
Again, you just kind of, what do you feel is that ordinary effort? You know, if it's a to the backhand side, you know, do you give the guy, you know, probably, you know, more leeway than you would to the glove side where they're fielding it more in front of them, so to speak. Yeah, and then again, it's the average fielder. You know, if a Daniel Murphy, you know, is not generally considered a great defensive player, but he'll make, you know, some plays that look pretty spectacular at times. He makes them look easy, but he'll also make maybe a routine ground ball look hard. You know, so you've got to judge all that, and it helps seeing those people. You know, like say with the Nationals, you know, I see them 30 to 35 times a season live, plus more on television. You get a feel for what that player can do. Danny Espinosa can get to more balls than a lot of shortstops in the game, but do you penalize him for getting to a ball and then maybe not making the play when, say, the next shortstop wouldn't even have gotten to the ball? So those are the things you've just got to, and it is difficult.
Those are quick decisions you have to make. You can't think about this longhand about whether Danny Espinosa might have had more range than some other fielder and shouldn't be
true.
Penalized for getting to a particular ground
true.
Ball. You have to kind of go with your gut.
Right. And that's a big thing. You know, generally, you know, the guideline is kind of, you know, make a decision before the next batter comes up. Now, you also have the option, you can go back later, make a change. You know, if you, the big bonus we have at the major league level is a TiVo system that they provide for us that we can roll it back, look it over, look again. And I say, sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad, you know, in my opinion, because like say at the minor league level, we don't have that. You know, you've got to make a decision. Now, okay, what you thought you saw, you know, did it take a bad hop? Is that a ball that he really should have fielded? My thing is kind of, if a guy has an opportunity to make a play, make the play. If you could field the ball with reasonable effort, you know, somebody would say, well, he wasn't going to throw him out though. Well, I don't know about that. You know, but if he could have fielded the ball with some ordinary effort, I'm probably going to give you an error, even though it might have been a close play at first base, theoretically. I want to see you make the play and make the throw. If the throw's late and the guy beats it, it's a hit. If it's not, you know, it's a play you could have made.
And so that feeds into my question I wanted to ask you, which is, if it's kind of a 50-50 play, it does not necessarily defer to a hit. I mean, it could well be an error that score too. It isn't, the default is not going to a hit unless you are absolutely convinced it's an error. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much so. And that's, you know, I tend to, if I'm borderline on a call, I will score it an error first, and knowing that I want to look at this again. My concept is I'd rather change from an error to a hit than from a hit to an error. And I think I can be convinced more to change from error to hit than to go backward. That's me, personally.
You think that's a typical attitude?
I'm not sure. You know, I haven't really talked to other scorers about that in that regard. I mentioned that to one of the writers one day that I'm a good friend with, and you know, he was like, "Well, why did you make that change?" And, well, you know, I said, and I explained to him, I want to go error first, you know, and see if I can convince myself that it should be a hit. And I think it's better. I think for the player, for the game itself, I think I'd rather have it that way. You know, if I can't convince myself that it should be a hit, then it's going to be an error. And I think if I go that way first, then I'm kind of leaning more that way. You know, and a lot of times, like you say, your first instinct is 90% right. You know, but there's time. Like say, you'll see a different angle, you'll see a different. You know, there was a play years and years ago in D.C. Remember, there, you know, ground ball to third, and it was, I couldn't tell if it took a bad hop right at the last minute or not. And, you know, from seeing it straight on, it didn't look that way. But the fielder had a difficulty with it. You know, so I scored it an error, and I was, like, waiting to find a different angle. I wanted to see the angle behind the player, to see what it had done. And the first few replays that got shown, you know, on television were, there was the one from the front, there was one from the side. That didn't really show what I needed to see. But finally, later on, they showed an angle from behind. And I could clearly see the ball took a hop that I didn't expect that it was going to take. I ended up changing it to a base hit. You know, so I say there's, you know, like I say, I'd rather go error first and then change it to the hit, you know, because then everybody's more happy, I guess, in one way.
You know, if a player has a particular statistical milestone, of course, no official scorer is going to change their scoring decision just to accommodate a particular on-field situation. The player is about to break a particular record and question whether it's a hit or an error.
Right.
You're not going to think about those things, right?
Generally, no, but you do. You know, there's been, I remember 2 years ago when Denard Span was having a really good season for the Nationals, and at the end he had about a 27 or 28 game hitting streak, you know, on the line. And like his third at bat, he hit a sharp ground ball to the right of the first baseman. That's a left-hander first baseman, so his glove's on his right hand, so it's his glove side that the ball's on. It's like, I think, a sharp one hopper. It gets to him, it's in his glove and out. Now, you got the argument. Is it hit hard enough that he couldn't react to it, and it's in his glove and out? Is it a situation where it took a hop that allowed to go in his glove and out? In my opinion, it was a ball that was, it was a sharp ground ball, but it was right at the guy. It was a ball that needed to be fielded. And the pitcher, I actually looked at the replay to see whether the pitcher was covering in time or not. He was. If the guy fields the ball, he's got time to flip to the pitcher covering. Span would have been out. I scored it an error. I got a brief argument from the Nationals media relations people. Obviously, he's got a 27-game, 28-game hitting streak at the time. But, you know, they said, would you mind taking another look? I said, sure, I'll take another look. Still felt the same way. I actually got a text from a friend watching the game. And they're like, how can you score that? He's got a 28-game hitting streak, you know. Kind of, and they put a smiley face. They were, you know, kind of joking with me. But, you know, I know it's kind of serious. And I said, don't worry. He'll get another at bat and he'll get a clean base hit. Just kind of joking along with him. He comes up in the eighth inning, clean base hit to right field. The pitting streak goes on. So, you know, I didn't have to go back later and say, okay, should this really be a hit or not? But in my opinion, at the time, it was an error. It stayed an error. But he did what he had to do, and he kept his hitting streak alive.
And do you make any effort to kind of stay out of things in the sense that an official scorer can have a profound impact on a game if he chooses to? I mean, one One example would be when Don Drysdale had his long scoreless inning streak, mm-hmm. and the official scorer made a decision that ultimately led to that streak continuing,
okay.
in a way. Do you make a particular effort to keep yourself out of things so as not to have that kind of situation occur?
I think you go into each game hoping nothing like that happens. I mean, I think it. You know, there's times you just can't avoid it. You know, if it's a situation, you know, I've had a number of times where, you know, there's a borderline play, say in the first inning, you know, on a ground ball that you score a hit. And, you know, then all of a sudden it's seven innings later and there hasn't been another hit. You know, and you're like, okay, am I going to have to go back and re-examine this? You know, and you're just like, give me a clean one. Give me a clean one somewhere, you know. And it's kind of funny. We have jokes about that. You know, somebody in this, you know, a reporter, a couple of the guys that I know as the reporters with the Nationals are friends. And, you know, they'll be like, you know, sixth inning, you know, a guy gets a ball in the gap that's a clean double. And they're like, you're off the hook, you know, and stuff like that. But, you know, you hope that never happens. And I guess the biggest, you know, is like on a no-hitter situation. There was the situation a few years ago when CC Sabathia, you know, had the no-hitter going in Milwaukee, and there was a slow grounder. He reached for it with his bare hand, kind of fumbled it, threw to first. It was late. You know, the official scorer scored it a hit. You know, and ended up was the only hit he gave up the whole day, and, you know, got kind of, you know, massacred over it. You know, well, that should have been an error. You know, he fumbled the ball. But it was, you know, his explanation was, you know, Sabathia felt it was to his glove side, but he elected to try to field the ball. It was slow enough, he just reached down with his bare hand. And the official scorer's reason, or what he explained, he said he felt that Sabathia at least felt enough that it was going to be a close enough play that he didn't have time to field it with his glove. So the fact that he actually, you know, fumbled it a little bit didn't make a difference. It was going to be a base hit if the guy beat the play, which he did. You know, and I actually had one of the reporters in Washington, I scored a game in D.C. like 2 days later, and one of the reporters came and he said, did you see all that? And I said, yeah. And he said, what did you think? And I said, well, I said, from my opinion, I said, it could have gone either way. I said, but in my opinion, the initial scoring, I don't think there was enough to change the other way. Now, if he had scored that an error, I'm not sure there was enough to say it should be a hit. By scoring it a hit, I'm not sure there was enough to say it should be an error. It was one of those pure borderline, you know, situations like today with the umpire things, you know, where they're either confirmed, stands, or overturned. You know, if they don't feel there's enough there to say, yes, definitely the play was done right, or that it was definitely done wrong, it comes out as it stands, you know, as called. So that means there's not enough evidence to overturn, you know, the call. So that's where you hope plays are clear cut and you know, the error's through the guy's legs, or it's launched over the guy's head, or what. But, you know, that's when you earn your money, is, you know, when you find that you got to make that tough decision. And you've got to stick by it.
Given that you have a deep understanding of the rule book, and that the rule book isn't necessarily perfect, are there rules you've come across and you said that rule should be changed?
There are a few I'm not crazy about. The part of the error rule where they say you don't give a guy an error for a misjudgment, like if an outfielder is charging a ball, thinks he's going to make the catch, realizes at the last second he's not, the ball hits and skips by him. Technically, you're not supposed to give that guy an error because he misjudged how he was approaching the ball. Okay, you know, it ends up rolling to the wall, it ends up a triple, where really it probably should be a single and a two-base error. In my mind, it should be a single and a two-base error, because you ought to be able to understand earlier in that situation, for me, you ought to be able to break down earlier if you realize you're not going to make it. But if you're diving for a ball, that's one thing, you know, and that sort of thing, you know. But that's one that I'm kind of, because to me, obviously, an error is a misjudgment, you know. So you, even a ground ball, you've somehow misjudged where the ball's going, you know, and committed an error. So that's one I wish was kind of maybe not in that.
if a fielder, let's just say the sun is not a factor, but just clearly just misjudges a pop-up.
Okay.
Isn't anywhere near it, but he otherwise would be, or a normal fielder would be. Doesn't touch the ball, and it falls right behind second base. Is that to you an error?
It can be. I mean, I think if the guy, like say, if he reasonably has an opportunity to field the ball, if he clearly can't find it, you know, say, like you said, the sun situation, you know, people have asked me, you know, the different, I mean, I've given errors on balls that guys are in the sun, but they've shown no indication that they're having a problem with it in the sun. Other guys are just, you know, they're standing there, they're like looking around, I have no clue, they're covering their heads, you know. And in that case, you know, somebody said, well, why can't that be an error? And I said, well, I said, it's tough to give an error to a guy who never saw the ball, you know, even if it landed 5 feet from me, you know. And in that case, it's generally given that's a base hit, you know. I've given errors on the, like other players, there's a situation in the Nationals were playing Tampa Bay 1 year, and there was a fly ball hit to right center field, and the center fielder came over, he's under it, and all of a sudden the right fielder for the Rays runs in front of him. And, you know, basically he missed the ball, and the ball actually hit the center fielder in his chest and dropped to the ground. Now, you're sitting there and say, okay, well, the center fielder didn't catch it, so it's an error on the center fielder. Well, no, it's an error on the right fielder for running in front of him, getting in his way, and blocking his vision from making what should have been a routine fly ball. So you get an E9 on that play instead of an E8, you know. And some people don't, you know, understand that, but it's that's what happened. The right fielder was the one who caused the error. It wasn't the center fielder.
Now, wild pitches versus pass balls. I mean, a wild pitch, the threshold seems to be if it hits the dirt, it's a wild pitch.
Mm-hmm. That's actually in the rule
book. In the rule book. Okay.
Right.
And is it still difficult for you to make those calls? Do you have trouble interpreting that rule?
With that part in the rule book, pretty much clear cut. If you see that it's hit the dirt, even if it's, you know, inches, you know, in front of the glove, you give it a wild pitch. The tough ones are like for us at Nationals Park, where the press box is, we're so high up that it's hard to see what's happened, especially on a ball that's close to the ground. So that's where the TV, the TiVo system comes in handy a lot of time. You can look down and it's like, well, how did he miss that? You know, and then you look down and it's like, oh, okay, it skipped 2 inches in front of me. You know, or no, it was 3 inches above the ground and he just blew it. You know, that becomes a pass ball. You know, we've had arguments at times too where a catcher will get crossed up, you know, by a pitch, you know, he's expecting a curveball and all of a sudden it's a fastball to his right and he goes, you know, at the last second to try and catch it. We actually, in our official scorers conference this past year, somebody brought that up. You know, what is reasonable in that situation to call it a fastball as opposed to a wild pitch? And the fellow that I mentioned earlier that had been the college coach for a number of years, he said his rule is that there's basically a radius of the catcher of what he can reasonably move his arm with the glove to catch. And he said, if it's anything outside of that, to him, it's a wild pitch. If it's within that radius, he, and I think he said it was about a 17, basically the width of the plate. radius, which I think 17 inches. He said, score to pass ball. He said, even if the guy is set up on the outside corner and the pitch comes to the inside corner, that's still reasonable to be expected that he could make a catch on the fly. So that's kind of one of the rules that I go by now with that.
Now for a long time, we had differing interpretations of the rule around second base, particularly when someone was in the middle of a double play and from the player's safety, they kind of moved out of the way,
the neighborhood of
second base. And I know we've had some interpretations as to whether that's really a good thing or not a good thing. And at what point do you think it is difficult from an official scorer's standpoint? I mean, the umpire may call him out at second base, but it could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
And if the guy doesn't touch second base, and he makes the throw to first, would you consider that an error on his part, or would you consider that, well, it's kind of within the context of the way the rule is applied, mm-hmm. so it really isn't an error?
I guess now with the new rule this year, I think it started this year with the where the players have to slide directly in the base, and they took away the neighborhood rule. You know, the player does have to stay on the base and make that call. If the umpire rules he's off the bag and there's no other out made, then yes, that's an error. You know, now if it's just, let's say it's a 4-6-3 situation. You know, the shortstop is off the bag, but he throws to first and gets the out at first base.
That's an out.
That's an out. There's no error related because you can't assume the double play, which is in the rule book. So where theoretically, you know, it goes down as a mental error. You know, you didn't stay on the bag long enough, or did the second baseman pull you off of the bag? You know, that sort of thing. But since an out was made, there is no physical error scored on the play. It would be the runner advances on a fielder's choice.
Now, you mentioned the that you cannot interpret that a double play would be made. But for a very long time, fans have known that a particular inning was shaped by a double play that wasn't turned or would clearly have been made.
Sure.
Do you believe that that should be under the official scorer's domain to interpret whether a double play should be made? Because you can talk about things like errors affecting earned run average and so forth, but the inability of a defense to turn a double play that clearly should be made affects innings throughout the season.
Sure.
What do you do about it?
That's a tough question. I mean, from an official scoring standpoint, I'd hate to have that on us, you know, to determine, well, you know, that run shouldn't have scored, so that has to be unearned. You know, I guess it's kind of in that situation of like a foul ball that gets dropped. You know, for years that would be scored if the batter, you know, ended up making an out anyway, you didn't score an error. You know, now the rule book changed, I think it's been at least 15 years ago, that you score the play as it happens. And, you know, if a guy clearly should have caught a foul pop and it drops, that's an error. You know, even if the guy on the next pitch strikes out, you know, and it didn't affect the big scheme of things, you know, anything, it's still an error. Because it was, you know, it extended the at bat. And that's another part of the definition of the error, is that, you know, the play that not made that extends an at bat. You know, but for a situation like you described, you know, the shortstop doesn't make the throw, or he pulls the guy off the bag, or, you know, or things, but it's not a official error. But to go back later and have to, I guess, kind of that same situation, you know, it's, you know, I don't know. I'd say from the official scorer standpoint, I would say wouldn't want that, you know, left to us to make a determination on that. It's been part of the game for forever. You know, there's parts of the game that, you know, for me, you know, play the game as it was built, in 1880. Yeah, there's things, obviously things have changed, but you know, that's to me kind of the beauty of the essence of the game. It is still the same game, you know, that was played in 1880 for the most part. You know, the guy who came up with, you know, nine batters, nine fielders, you know, nine innings, 90 feet, you know, how did he know that that was perfect? You know, it's turned out it's perfect, you know, it works. And, you know, especially when everything else in our culture is based on tens and fives.
That's right.
You know, and it's amazing. But yeah, that would be tough to be have to go back and make that determination.
How do you feel about sacrifice flies? And I ask it because if imagine a team is down by a run and ninth inning, one out, and the batter, let's say it's a power hitter who is aiming for the fences, and there's a runner on third base, and the guy swings with all his might, is clearly attempting to hit a home run in that particular situation, but he comes just a little bit short. And then the runner comes home, scores, and it ties the game. But he had been aiming for a two-run home run.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get charged with an official at bat under the assumption that he was trying to hit a fly ball, even though he wasn't in this case trying to hit a fly ball. And there's a certain unfairness in that scenario. Is this one of those rules that's been around forever and we just have to apply it? Or is there a point when giving a batter who is not trying to push a ball to the outfield for a sacrifice fly should be charged with an at bat?
I would have no problem with that. I mean, you know, to me, a sacrifice fly, you get credit for the run batted in. You know, why you get the no at bat, you know, if the same guy with a runner at third hits a ground ball to second and, you know, the runner scores and they throw the guy out at first, he doesn't get a sacrifice.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't get a no time at bat. And, you know, I have no problem with the no at bat part of the sac fly rule being taken out. I mean, like you say, you do get credit for the RBI. You drove in the run.
Right.
You know, so you've done that part of what you were attempting to do. You were trying to drive in the run. You know, you did it. Okay. You know, I'm not sure why that ever started. You know, to be in one guy, it was probably somebody that was a power hitter that said, you know, okay, help me out with my batting average. And
it can make a big difference if it were,
sure,
10 or 15 sacrifice flies over the course of the year. But we seem to have no problem at all saying, oh, that was a bunt where he was trying to sacrifice versus bunting for a base hit. And everyone who's watching can tell.
Right.
And there are definitely situations where giving up and out isn't a good idea.
True.
And so no reasonable person would be aiming for a sacrifice fly. And it's the same thing when a runner late in the game might steal a base. We say, oh, it's defensive indifference. And so we interpret the situation and credit the statistics accordingly.
Right.
And it seems as though with sacrifice flies, we haven't quite caught up to things.
I agree. I would agree with that. Yeah. Like I say, I'd have no problem, you know, doing away with the no at bat part of that. Because like you say, they're not theoretically giving themselves up, you know, to do that.
And I would venture that more batters than not are aiming for a hit than they are to give themselves up, except in, let's say, one-run situations and so forth.
And I say, the only difference, and it may be where it came in initially, you know, I can understand the concept of trying to hit a fly ball, you know, to get it out of the infield, to potentially
double play.
Have it, that and the fact that it's going to be deep enough that run can score. For the fact of if you're giving yourself up in that situation, you know, quote unquote, you know, I don't really agree with that 100% or 50% or.
I had a talk with Barry Bloom, MLB reporter, and one of his ideas going forward was that, you know, with baseball wins now, especially with the specialization in the bullpen, don't mean as much, and that we won't have 300 game winners henceforth, and that
right.
maybe down the line we should have official scorers decide in virtually every game who is deserving of a particular, forget about 5 minutes
mm-hmm.
or anything like that, that the official scorer should decide kind of who was the pitcher who did the most to help his team win on that particular day, which would put an extra burden on an official scorer to figure out, you know, especially if we had multiple relievers in there, which reliever deserves it.
Right.
Is that a solution which has any merit? One benefit to it is that it could potentially increase starting pitchers' win totals and make them more consistent with statistics from past generations. And sort of level things out in this era of reliever specialization.
Mm-hmm.
But the burden would probably shift to you under such a plan.
Right. I understand the concept. The five-inning rule has been there for so long that it's, you know, like, say, it's become an ingrained
yeah.
part of the game. You know, I'm not as big a fan, you know, the Brian Kinneys of the world who want wins just done away with. You know, to me, it still means something to a starting pitcher. And a starting pitcher who is consistent enough to pitch that 6-7 innings, you know, a Tanner Roark, Max Scherzer for the Nationals, Strasburg when he was, you know, healthy. You know, to me, that helps the bullpen to the fact of they don't, you know, you don't have six guys pitching out of the bullpen every day, you know, which they don't have. You know, and you see most teams, you know, it's rare after, you know, you might have a solid closer, you know, fewer have a solid setup man, even fewer have a solid seventh inning guy, you know, that can do, you know, finish that game, you know, for you, like the Royals had, you know, the last few years. You know, this year, watching the Nationals for most of the season, you know, you'd sit there and be like, you prayed to just get to the closer, you know, because it was, you couldn't really trust who you were going to trust, you know, outside of that to get you there. But
there is an interpretation in the sense that, let's say with the save rule, there was always mm-hmm. that if a pitcher came in and pitched effectively, whatever that meant,
right.
For three innings, then the official scorer could give that person a save. And I guess the wins issue may come down to whether you also would interpret whether someone had pitched effectively.
Right. And that's a good point. That's a good point. You know, I think, like you say a starting pitcher had gone seven, let's say it's a 6-3 game. The starting pitcher went seven innings. He gave up the three runs, gave up about 10 hits. He was kind of all over the place, you know, for most of the game. But he kept getting out of it, you know, and effectively, you know, not making it worse. You know, to me, he's done his job, you know, to the point of he should probably get the win for that game, even if a reliever came in and, say, you know, even pitched the last three innings and struck out all nine batters. You know, in the theory of who would you give the win to in that, you'd be like, well, obviously the reliever was more effective, you know, than the starter. But the starter did his job of keeping his team in the game through six innings to allow the reliever to come in at that point. So it would be interesting as to that interpretation. I mean, we actually, you know, yesterday in the Nationals playoff game on October 9th against the Dodgers, the game two of the NLDS, you know, situation, Tanner Roark comes out in the fifth. He didn't go these five innings to, you know, be able to qualify for the win. But the next couple of relievers, you know, one guy pitched an inning in the third, gave up no runs, but he walked three batters. He constantly had guys on base, but he got out of it. You know, then there was another pitcher who came in, got one out to get out of the inning. A new reliever comes in. You know, it ended up Dave Vincent made the decision. Blake Treinen got the win because he pitched the last out of the seventh and through the eighth inning. He retired all four batters he faced. In Dave's opinion, he was the most effective, you know, of those, that group of relievers, and within Mark Melanson getting the save. in the ninth inning. So in that case, you know, I agree with it. But, you know, Roark battled his butt off, you know, for 4 1/3 innings. He left the game behind 2-0, but he kept them in the game. You know, so where he wasn't overly effective, he was effective. You know, so that's kind of an interesting thing on that concept. And you talked about the save rule. There, you mentioned earlier, is there a rule that I would change? To me, the save rule, there's the three parts of the save rule. One, the main part is the pitcher enters the game with the tying run either on base, at bat, or on deck. Okay. So you could have as much as a 5-run lead and come into the game. If the bases are loaded, the tying run's on deck. That's a save situation. The pitch one inning with a lead of no more than 3 runs. I've seen too many guys over here that come in, give up a pair of solo homers, have 2 more guys on base, and get out of the inning, and they get credited with a save that, you know, they were anything but saving that game. You know? And the 3-run or the 3-inning rule, actually, like you mentioned, it used to actually say if the pitch 3 innings effectively. That part's been taken out the last few years, the effectively part. And I'm not sure if it was actually me or not, but there was a game about 6-7 years ago in Washington. They're playing the Miami Marlins. Both teams are awful. The Marlins end up winning the game, I think, 18-11. They had a relief pitcher come in, pitch the 7th, 8th, and 9th. He entered the game, I believe the score was like 16-5. Well, he gives up 4 or 5 runs over the 3 innings. I think gave up like 7 hits, walked 2 or 3. I can't remember the exact rule. I did not give him a save. Because in my opinion, he did not pitch 3 innings effectively. The next year, the effectively part went out of the rule book. So I don't know if I changed a rule or not, but it's possible.
Going back to what we talked before about objectivity. You're up in the press box, but you also are able to go on the field if you wish, I believe.
Prior to the games.
Mm-hmm. And so there are opportunities for interactions with managers or players or whomever. To what degree do you try and isolate yourself from other outside forces to make sure that you're not lobbied on a call maybe from the day before or to have anyone try and influence you because you really do need to remain objective?
Right. Well, since I've been an official scorer since 2005, the letter we receive each year from our people at Major League Baseball clearly expresses in it you are not to interact with players, managers, coaches. Their purpose is they don't want you to generate a relationship that could potentially affect your objectivity. So to be honest, I've actually never done that. I would love at times, you know, say the day after a game, let's say the shortstop, you know, made an error on a ball that took a kind of a weird hop. I'd love to go down and ask him the next day, you know, after things have cooled down, what happened on that play? You know, why didn't you field the ball? You know, clearly, but you know, do you feel it was a ball you should have fielded? I would love to do that. I'd love to get inside these guys' heads and get more information, but we are discouraged from doing that, you know, from that standpoint. I'd like to think that, you know, I could continue to keep a neutrality, keep an objectivity, but you never know. You might, you know, I've got favorite players, I'll admit it, and different things, and, you know, you might sit there and be like, okay, well, you know, yesterday he said that took a bad hop on him, so today it took a bad hop and that's a hit. You know, where maybe it really should be an error, you know, and that sort of thing. So I have talked in the press box now with former players who are now scouts, you know, broadcasters who are former players, get their opinions, you know, on some things. And that does help. But the current active players, you know, we are discouraged from from having an interaction with. And actually, if there's a question after a game, it's supposed to go through, let's say a player, you know, was charged with an error and he's like, well, you know, that should have been a base hit, you know, I can't believe that. It's to go through their media relations person to contact us. It's not a direct.
Doesn't always work that way.
No, doesn't always work that way, but that's the protocol of what's supposed to happen.
It sounds as though, and I know a lot of fans will score the game at home, mm-hmm. but there is a necessity of being at the ballpark when you are the official scorer. You couldn't just do what you do in front of the television, in part because you have to account for factors around the park, such as wind or something like
True.
That. And baseball has, you know, in being able to see the entire field, I imagine, is also quite important to you. Are there mm-hmm. other reasons why being at the ballpark would matter and would give you information that you wouldn't otherwise get?
I like the fact that, like I say, you know, I was talking earlier about the, you know, at the minor leagues you don't have to play. And it's, you basically got to score what you thought you saw. I still like that from the standpoint of, I see it live, you know, the ball's hit, it's on the field, I see what happened. If I then want to go and look at a replay at the major league game, you know, more times than not, I will do that, especially on a ball that's been misplayed, to make sure the replay shows me what I thought I saw. But I'd say probably 80%, 85% of my scoring decisions are based on the initial live play. And like I say, if you're watching it just on television, you maybe don't get the angle. I mean, there's been a number of times, you know, even trying to watch the replay, you know, the television replay, you're starting with the shot from center field of the pitcher throwing the ball home. Well, the contact's made, they then switch to the shot from behind home plate to where you see out to the field. Well, there's a number of times where that ball's hit so hard that in that split second of them switching, the ball's already on the fielder, and you don't get that live, you know, shot again, you know, of that. So I think there is definitely a benefit of being there live. Like you say, you know the wind conditions, you know whether, you know, is there a mist falling, you know, is there a heavier rain falling? Those things can play into, you know, if a guy takes two steps and slips, you know, how does that, you know, play into whether it's a hit or an error? You know, obviously if he slips and falls and can't get to the ball, it's a base hit. Where, you know, if it's a dry field, you know, he maybe gets there, you know, and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I think there definitely is a benefit to being there live.
Having done official scoring on the major league level for 12 years mm-hmm. and minor league baseball before then, how often do you see things that you haven't seen before?
I will bring that up to people every year. Every year I will see something that I have never seen before. And like I said, I've been doing this in some capacity for like 35 years, and it never fails that a play will happen that I've never seen before. We had one in Washington a few years back when Adam Dunn was still with Cincinnati. He was at bat, second baseman. I can't think of his name right now. He's still with them.
Brandon Phillips?
Yes, Brandon Phillips was on first base. The Nationals go into the shift with second baseman out in short right. The shortstop's playing over. Ryan Zimmerman, then the third baseman, he's playing, you know, maybe 10 to 15 feet to the left of second base. Phillips takes off for a stolen base on a ball that's in the dirt. Okay. Brian Schneider was the Nationals catcher at the time. He fields it, comes up, but he's got no play. Phillips has got the base stolen, so didn't even make a throw. Okay. Well, Zimmerman had been the person to come over to cover the bag at second base because he's the closest one. Well, Phillips slides into second, pops up. About that time, Schneider just kind of lobs the ball back to the pitcher. Well, Schneider realizes Zimmerman's standing right beside him. There's nobody at third base. He takes off. Zim's chasing him, yelling for the ball.
Go Nats.
Go Nats. And he, takes the pitcher finally throws it to him, but he's so, behind him, Phillips moves into third base unobstructed. So all of a sudden I look and the entire press box is staring at me. What's the call? And I'm like, okay. So I'm like, to me it was two stolen bases. He stole second and he realized there's nobody at third. He took off. It wasn't, in my opinion, it wasn't a fielder's choice, because it wasn't just a matter of somebody didn't throw to the right base or that sort of thing. It was just he took advantage of the open base and he took off and got the stolen base. This is like the fourth inning of the game. So I announced two stolen bases, on the internal PA. As soon as the inning ended, I called the Elias Sports Bureau, our kind of Bible, for the official scores. They have a person on staff during each day that's a rules expert. And I had looked through the rule book. There's, of course, nothing in there that will explain that situation. So I said, here's the situation. Here's what I scored. Is there a precedent? Do you think it shouldn't be that way? What do you think? And the guy was like, okay. He said, let me look up some things. And he said, I'll get back to you. Well, it's like the bottom of the eighth. I still haven't heard back from him. And finally, my phone rings, and it's the guy from Elias. And he said, Ben, I can't find any precedent on this. He said, but I agree with you. I think it's two stolen bases. And I said, okay. I said, that's all I need. I just needed somebody to back me up.
But I wonder, when you are in a pinch, it sounds like Elias is who you call.
Correct.
As opposed to other official scorers you might know. And...
Right. Now, I'll talk, there's situations in the press box in Washington. We'll have Phil Wood, local broadcaster who's, the expert on Washington baseball. Phil was actually an official scorer in Baltimore for about 10 years back in the 90s. And at certain games, Mark Jacobson, who is an official scorer for the Baltimore Orioles, will be in Washington serving in a capacity for another stat service for Stats Inc. And, I might touch base with them, during a game. I'm like, I called that an error. What do you think? And they'll give me an opinion. So I'm not trying to change your mind, but I thought X. Sometimes they back me up. Sometimes they're like,
You better have an open mind in these things.
And they do. And if I'm approaching them, I've got the open mind because I'm not positive that I made the right call.
You can probably make 95% or more of calls, and it's that hard 5%.
Right. Right. And I agree with that. And I say, I'm not one that will not look for help. There are people, that I trust. Those guys, they're some of the reporters I know have been around the game for a long time, have seen it. What do you think? As long as in the end it's my final decision, but I have no problem soliciting, other opinions. I know some scorers don't want to do that at all, but I don't have a problem with that. In the end, it's got to be me that's got to live with it. And like I tell people that I, if I'm training a scorer at a lower level or something, to me, I tell them, I said, when you make a decision, be ready to sell it. You have to believe in it.
It's not like when you sell it, you're going in front of the press and saying, I decided it for this reason.
Right.
So in some sense, you have to do it, but kind of like a football referee, you don't always have the platform to explain the rationale, which can be hard, I imagine.
True, absolutely. And I say when I say sell it, is make sure you believe that's the right call. If you believe it's the right call and somebody questions you about it, you can say, well, it's the right call because A, B, and C. And then they're like, oh, okay, I got that now. Then that's good. But if you're not positive, if you can't sell the call, then maybe you didn't get it right. And, like I say, I'm willing to listen to discussion. I'm not listening to somebody yell at me, but I'm more than happy to listen to a discussion about the play.
If some young person wanted to be an official scorer, What would they do to do it? You said and mentioned how you were in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
So it may not be possible for someone to exactly emulate your own career path.
Right.
Nor is someone trying to be a full-time official scorer, because it doesn't really happen that way.
Mm-hmm.
So suppose someone is 20 years old and wants to be an official scorer. What's the best route?
I would tell them go to as many games as they can, you know, sit and watch, you know, get the rule book, understand the rule book, understand the intricacies of the different rules of what is a hit, what is an error. You know, if the possibility, if the opportunity arises where you can do it with a professional or a veteran official scorer, you know, sit with them, discuss plays. You know, it's the biggest thing. I keep bringing up our official scorers conference, you know, in New York, but I think I've learned more in those conferences because I'm talking to other people who are trying to do the same thing. And I remember the very first year in 2012, they gave us actually kind of a quiz. You know, they had about 25 different plays on video. No sound, no anything, you know, not the broadcasters talking, just watch the play, score it. Okay, then we'll go back over. And the concept kind of coming into that conference was, you brought up earlier, you know, how many are homers, how many, you know, that somebody, let's say the guy in Pittsburgh is scoring this play, play X is being scored differently in Pittsburgh than it is in San Diego. Okay. When we went through those plays, every time when somebody, okay, well, who has hit on this play? The majority of people were in cohesion on it. You know, or, okay, you know, who has hit? 27 hands would go up. Who has error? 3 hands would go up. Okay, why do you have error? Well, I thought da 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 da. Well, okay, here's why it's not an error, you know, and you'd get the explanation. Okay, okay, well, I didn't quite see, you know, that part of it. I understand now. But that was the thing, and I thought there was more cohesion in our scoring around the majors than people, I think, thought there was. And that's been a great thing, and I think, like you say, it's even led to more. Because, like I say, there's not as many times I'll watch a game on TV and say, well, I just scored that a hit and that person gave it an error. Yeah, there's not too many times when that happens anymore.
And there's a benefit for each team having multiple official scorers, so you don't have a particular team be associated with a particular kind of ruling.
Correct.
Kind of evens everything out.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Now, we have gone more than an hour. I wanted to find out if there are other topics on official scoring that you would like to highlight that I might not have mentioned.
Can't think of any. You know, like I say, it just, I really appreciate, you know, what the teams do, you know, to help us, even though we're technically not their employee. You know, they accept us as one of their own and, you know, work with us and everything. And, you know, I think there's that respect that, you know, I mean, I know, like say, a lot of the reporters or other people will come up to me, you know, at different times and it's like, you know, I could never do your job. You know, that's too tough. And, you know, my personality myself is, you know, I'm kind of a laid back person. I don't seek confrontation, you know, I said, but I feel like I've got more of a backbone maybe from doing this job because of having to defend, you know, your situation and things like that, that, you know, somebody comes and, oh, you know, that shouldn't be a hit, that's an error. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's an error now. You know, no, I've, you know, this is why it's not an error, you know, and that sort of thing. But it's fun. It's a fun job. I said there's times where sometimes it's not as much fun, you know, when everybody in the world thinks you're against them or something. But you know, I enjoy it. It's you know, I love baseball. This is a great way to be involved in baseball. And I'm just happy to have been given the opportunity and 12 years later still be doing it.
Ben Tritipo, thank you for taking the time to speak with me for this Sabre Oral History.
John, thank you very much.